A very warm welcome to everyone coming online. Good afternoon from Singapore, and thank you for joining us for this book talk hosted by the Middle East Institute at the National University of Singapore. Today, we have with us a distinguished guest speaker, Professor Mihran Kamrava, and we will discuss his book titled Righteous Politics, Power and Resilience in Iran, very shortly. Firstly, to give you a snapshot of Professor Kamrava's profile, he is Professor of Government at the Georgetown University, Qatar, and also directs the Iranian Studies Unit at the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies. Being a prolific author, he has many book titles to his name. I will not go through the entire list, but the latest ones include Power and Resilience in Iran, which we will discuss today, and also A Dynastic History of Iran, From the Qajars to the Pahlavis, published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. Another title of his is A Concise History of Revolution, published also by Cambridge University Press in 2020. He has also published on various topics such as water insecurity in the Gulf, Palestine, and Qatari politics. These days, he is kept very busy by media requests. So thank you, Professor Kamrava. Good to have you with us today. If you'd like to purchase the book discussed today, there is a discount code that we will be showing in the chat box and sharing there, and also on our event page once the book talk concludes. So the code is KAMRAVA23, KAMRAVA23. I will repeat this at the end of the session. So further, if you have any burning questions as we progress into the book discussion, please send them, please send your questions into the chat box. So without further ado, let us now turn to our guest speaker, Professor Kamrava. Mihran, thank you for joining us. My first question for you today is, why Righteous Politics as the book title, and how does this particular title stand out from your other recent books on Iran, which I notice have been released in the past few years, past 3 years, I think. Over to you, Mihran.
Thank you, Clemens. Let me start out first by thanking you personally for this honor. I'm honored and privileged to be here. It's a pleasure. My collaboration with MEI and NUS goes back a number of years, and it's a pleasure being here. And I also want to thank the team at MEI for making this possible and for having invited me to give this book talk. Going to your question, Clemens, I wrote my PhD dissertation on the Iranian Revolution. And that was ages and ages ago, back in 1989. And I published that in 1990. And then for a number of years, I was interested in exploring other topics. I went back to the study of Iran in 2008. I wrote a book called Iran's Intellectual Revolution. But then again, for a number of years, I moved here to Doha in 2009. And Arab Spring, 2007 rather, and I wrote a bunch of other things, and Arab Spring happened, and I explored many different dimensions of the Arab world. But then at some point, I wanted to study Iran again. I wanted to get back into the in-depth study of Iran. And what was most significant to me, the most significant question to me is, how is this political system still standing? How is it standing despite its own internal contradictions? How is it standing despite self-inflicted wounds? And how is it standing despite the massive amount of pressure which it is under internationally and from multiple directions from abroad? I discovered in the process is that this is a political system that is highly complex, highly solid, very solid political system, but also one that is that considers itself deeply ideological. And this deep ideological feature of this state makes it feel that it is indeed a righteous state. It feels that it has divine mandate to rule the way it does, and that the highest institution of the political system, that of the Velayat-e-Faqih, according to the current interpretation, is sanctioned by none other than God. And so that being the case, the political system feels that it is truly has the mandate of heaven.
Thanks, Mehran. Based on your answer, I think I have two further questions, if you allow me. You categorize Iran as a hybrid authoritarian state. How does this distinguish from a fully authoritarian state? And you mentioned Wilayat-e-Faqih system. And this actually revolves, you know, by nature around a central personality. But also in your book, you said that it is far from personalist and relies on, you know, a whole series and layers of other things. So can you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, indeed. First of all, let me go to your second question first. The political system of the Velayat-e-Faqih, as you know, came about in 1979 and was enshrined in the constitution. And steadily, we have seen an evolution of the institution, not just constitutionally, but also in actual practice. And what we've seen is that the Velayat-e-Faqih, at the end of its first decade, right before the founder of the Islamic Republic passed away, Khomeini, he articulated the notion of the absolute Velayat-e-Faqih. And interestingly, at the time, the current Velayat-e-Faqih in the late 1980s actually questioned the notion of absolute Velayat-e-Faqih. And Khamenei kind of slapped him in the back of the hand somewhat publicly in a letter and said, look, what the Velayat-e-Faqih says goes, and regardless of whether or not it is in contravention of the established tenets of Islam. And so we have seen a steady evolution of the institution of the Velayat-e-Faqih into what it is today. And today it is much more powerful than the former monarchy of the pre-revolutionary Iran could ever have imagined, could ever have dreamt. It is in charge of an economic empire, a vast amount of political institutions, tremendous resources, and of course, constitutionally, the Velayat-e-Faqih is also the commander-in-chief. So what we've seen is kind of the steady evolution. And one of the things I talk about in this book and in another book is the notion of Khameneism. And I need to give credit to the person who coined the term Khomeiniism, history professor, Ervand Abrahimyan came up with the term Khomeiniism, and I have taken that concept and applied it to the current Velayat-e-Faqih, and he has molded it according to his own personality, his own idiosyncrasies, his own priorities. And of course, the current Velayat-e-Faqih is 84 years old, and even supreme leaders at some point will die. And so the institution will reflect the idiosyncrasies of its occupant and the priorities of its occupant. And we have to wait and see how the institution will evolve in the post-Khamenei era.
Thanks, Mehran. And I come back to the question about authoritarianism.
Yes.
You call it hybrid authoritarian state. How so?
Well, it's a hybrid authoritarian state, at least up until today. We don't know if it's going to go a different model. But at least theoretically, there have been presidential elections and there have been parliamentary elections that have meant something. And every once in a while, these presidential elections particularly have thrown out a surprise. So in 1997, we had a surprise. In 2013 and again 2017. 2017 wasn't so much of a surprise, but both the presidencies of Khatami and then Rouhani indicated that this was a political system that had not only very robust authoritarian features, but it gave itself some safety valves that allowed it to have some cosmetic democratic features. And these cosmetic democratic features were either in the form of parliamentary elections or presidential elections, or even to a lesser extent later on in the form of municipal elections. So far, elections have meant something. Now, having said that, the last two elections, the 2021 presidential election, and then the election that we had last Friday for the Iranian parliament, have both been progressively less free. And they have, in fact, the 2021 election is technically called engineered election, that even Khamenei came out and said the Guardian Council, which vets candidates, didn't do justice, something to that effect, or they were not as munificent as they could have been. And so we have had this hybrid authoritarian system that increasingly has moved in the direction of full authoritarianism. We have to wait and see about the next presidential election. But so far, initial indications are that elections have become less and less meaningful. So in other words, one of the analogies I use for myself is that Iran is going the model of Egypt, for example, whereby the president keeps getting reelected, and we will have one of these elections in which the president will only serve two terms, unlike in the Arab republics, but elections really are increasingly meaningless, and that few number of candidates are allowed to run.
Thanks, Mehran. And I think if I were to tie this in with your initial comments, when you said that the Islamic Republic is still standing because of internal stresses and also external pressures, and yet the kind of institutional design, you know, allows some venting points for the citizens, for the people. And this can be cosmetic, as you said. So this comes back to one line that I remember reading from your book, which is the Iranian state is its own worst enemy. And I remember that line particularly well, because what do you mean by that? Is it because of its own institutional design? Is it because of the inflexibility? Or is it because of, like you said, the move right now towards a full authoritarianism? So what is it that makes it its own worst enemy?
Clemens, it's all of those things that you mentioned. The state is so determined in some ways. First of all, it's a highly balkanized state. So although right now we have supposed factional unity, but many of the individuals in the state are now busy trying to protect their interests in the post-Khamenei era. And so one of the interesting things that we see is that the various institutions and resources of the state are being used for political posterity in the day after, because nobody knows how the constellation of political forces in Iran will ultimately shape in the day after, once the dust settles and if there is any kind of a reconfiguration of the political system or political forces, the kind of different positions of the political forces. So that's something to take into account. What was the question again?
So it was whether it's its own institutional design.
Oh, yes, yes. The state is its own enemy. Yes,
exactly.
So look, sometimes the political system operates in a way that it deliberately tries to antagonize those people among whom it tries to have legitimacy. So, you know, one of the points I make is that this political system, by most accounts, has legitimacy among 15 to 20% of the population. there is that 15% that is diehard ideological believers that believes in the political system. And there's others that I mentioned in the book that are direct economic beneficiaries of the system. But there is, you know, we can argue over the numbers, but there's that diehard minority that it, the system tries deliberately to make sure its support it continues to have. But that 80 to 85 to 90% of the population, or 80 to 85% of the population, it's as if the state doesn't care about them and makes no effort whatsoever to not only enhance its popularity and deepen its popularity among that population, but to not actively antagonize them. Sometimes it just actively antagonizes through some of its cultural restrictions, some of its strictures on culture and popular culture. And so what we have seen over the last, particularly over the last 5 to 7 years, is this growing chasm between that has always been there, but it has become even wider between the people, the kind of the rhythm of life in Iran and the rhythm of culture and society and what the state is trying to do. And so the gap between state and society in Iran is now wider than it has ever been in the past. And this regime kind of does very little to at least enhance some of its popularity, or not to actively antagonize itself among that 80%, because it wants to stick to that 20% or 15%. And I think, Clemens, there's one thing that I want to mention here that's important, and I talk about it in the book. One of the primary reasons that the state is still standing, apart from everything else, apart from its institutional strength, apart from its multiple tentacles deep within Iranian society, apart from its nasty, repressive features that every once in a while we witness kind of in very blatant and brutal fashion, part of the reason is because society has exited from politics. By and large, there's this apathy that that the costs of political activism, or the costs of proactive political nonconformity, are prohibitively high. And so what the population does is that it kind of exits from politics. You know what? We give up. And people exit either literally with their feet and migrate out of the country, or they exit psychologically and kind of throw their hand up and say, you know what, the repressive bunch is there, and let them spew out their own ideological beliefs, and we're going to, as much as possible, carry on with our own life in the way that we want to.
Yes, Mihran, I think that kind of exit points, that kind of the search to exit, the search for an exit, the search for a venting point, which hasn't worked, you know, prompts the people to find other solutions to the problems internally. Before I want to turn to the current state of affairs, which is the elections that are ongoing, I wanted to remind our viewers that you can put in your questions through the chat box if you have any, and feel free to send them in. So my next question is about the current state of affairs, because it's the Assembly of Experts elections that we've been seeing. And, you know, and this assembly is meant to obviously, oversee the next Wilayat of Faqih. But at the same time, you know, in your book, you mentioned that since the inception of the Assembly of Experts, this has become mostly a ceremonial institution. So have things changed? You know, will the Assembly of Experts still have some say in the kind of succession for Khamenei? You know, what will we see next, to be honest?
That's a very important question. as I mentioned, constitutionally, the job of the Assembly of Experts is supervision of the Velayat-e Faqih. Now, there's been a lot of discussion and not necessarily debate, but a lot of ink has been spilt inside Iran as to precisely what the constitution means when it talks about supervision. Is it supervision of the election? Is it supervision of the person of the Faqih? Is it what is super? Does supervision mean approval? The constitution tends to be vague on precisely what supervision means, the mechanisms through which it can be carried out, the frequency of it being carried out, and that vagueness has left tremendous room for interpretation. And the interpretation that has kind of emerged parallel with the notion of the absolute Velayat-e Faqih is that it's not supervision, but really approval of the edicts and approval of the decrees of the Velayat-e Faqih. And so the kind of the whole notion of supervision has changed from one of looking over and making sure that the Velayat-e Faqih functions properly and kind of is of moral standards or upholds moral standards to one of simply kind of approving the functions of the or the decrees and the actions of the sitting Velayat-e Faqih. And this, of course, is a direct product of the relationship that has emerged since 1989 between Khamenei on the one side and the various key figures within the Assembly of Experts on the other. And so, you know, this personalism that has permeated the political system. So in one way to look at the Iranian political system is that it's the kind of ultimate neo-patriarchal system or ultimate neo-patrimonial system in which you have robust institutions, but a relationship of a very close personal relationship has emerged between key figures within the Assembly of Experts and the person of Khamenei, whereby the assumption has been and the narrative has been coming from the Assembly of Experts that this man is so preeminent and he is given that he is ordained by the Almighty, there's no need to supervise him. And instead, what we need to do is to make sure that we approve his actions. And of course, when the position is vacant, we will pick a successor.
Yes. And Mehran, thank you for that. And you showed also in your book that the voter turnout, you know, for the elections to the Assembly of Experts has steadily declined over the years. I think it began with something like 70+% and now, and when the last, well, based on the table that you showed, 2016, 61% of voters turn up to vote. What can we say about it? Is it reflective of the public frustration that we are seeing? And what can we expect in terms of the voter turnout in the coming years and even now?
That's also a very key point. First of all, we should remember that worldwide parliamentary elections tend not to have high turnout, and that there are, given the peculiarities of the Iranian political system, there are a number of these so-called parliamentary elections. There's the Assembly of Experts, there's the actual Islamic Assembly, the actual parliament, and then there's the presidency. Now, we have seen, if you put the figure 61% and compare it with other parliamentary elections, it's actually pretty good. But for the Iranian context, which, as you mentioned, the participation rate has gone down steadily, that is not a very good trend. And I don't know what the turnout, I don't think we know yet what the turnout in the last election was, but I'm willing to bet that it was even less than 61%, far less, because for the parliament, it was 41%. And so when those figures become available, I'm pretty sure they'll be even lower. So what this says is this growing disenchantment that I mentioned earlier, the fact that the hybrid authoritarian system is becoming less and less hybrid and more authoritarian. The fact that the chasm between state and society, between the Islamic Republic and the population over whom it rules, has become wider than ever before. And so the Assembly of Experts, you know, for example, that one of the candidates for the Assembly of Experts was rejected for re-election. And that candidate was none other than the very popular, or not very popular, but initially very popular President Hassan Rouhani. So even former President Rouhani was not allowed to run for re-election in the Assembly of Experts. And so once the population sees that, it becomes increasingly more disenchanted. And this, of course, is taking part in the context of a robust debate inside Iran, a very public one, among the so-called reformists, or what is left of them, whether or not to boycott elections. Do elections mean anything? And once that's in the public domain, once that discourse has become public, and some of the mainstays and some of the main figures within this state come right out and question the usefulness and the utility of taking part in elections, then, of course, you can imagine that even more people become disenchanted and become reluctant to vote.
Thanks, Mihran. And I think, yes, you're quite right to say that there's public disenchantment, but there's also political apathy. I think we should also differentiate the nuances between those kind of feelings and sentiments on the ground, which also answers, I guess, one of the questions that just came in about despair. The question was whether we can say that Iranians have gone beyond despair to not caring. I think apathy and despair, I think those are also different sentiments on the spectrum of emotions that the public feels. But I wanted to come back to this.
Sorry, I like the word despair, I may just interject here. In 2022, I published a book on kind of a political history of the Islamic Republic from 1979 up to 2022. And the title is Triumph and Despair. And in some ways, Iran has gone from triumph triumph not only during the revolution, but having emerged and having come out of a war, the longest war of the 20th century, that was absolutely devastating. And wars never have any winners. But if we're going to kind of look objectively, the Iranian nation emerged in some ways victorious, or at least still standing from the war. It triumphed over adversity, but that triumph has steadily become a sense of despair, a sense of hopelessness. And sense of despair and hopelessness is quite crushing. It's not necessarily a motivator, but it can be very crushing and dispiriting.
Thanks, Mihran. I want to still touch on, and while we are still on the topic of the public, because in your book, you talked about the protests that happened, and you mentioned how protests, the geographic distribution of protests, have shifted away from Tehran, from the larger metropolitan areas, into smaller towns and provincial cities. And this is unprecedented, as you said. So, you know, what do such protests and the spillover of such protests into the smaller areas, the rural areas, signify? You know, what is the kind of tipping point for the people that allows such protests to actually seep into the smaller towns and provincial areas?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. You know, the traditional assumption has been that the smaller towns and provincial areas are more supportive of the state, or would be more traditional, more conservative, and therefore more supportive of the state. Neither public opinion data nor polls bear that out. And in fact, we have seen that steadily provinces have voted for the other candidate, not the establishment candidate, if not necessarily the opposition figure. But some of the, for example, when reformists were allowed to run, they did quite well in some of the smaller towns and some of the provincial towns. So, you know, our kind of traditional assumptions need to be recalculated. And one of the interesting things we have seen is that, you know, despite, now, having said this, one of the complexities of Iranian political system has been that despite this kind of tilt towards the other candidate or the non-establishment candidate, we haven't seen acts of protest in the smaller towns and in the provinces historically, and now we're seeing them because some of the local conditions, for example, lack of water, or environmental conditions, environmental degradation, drought, agricultural underproduction, have become difficult to ignore. And that the assumption has been that the central government in Tehran either doesn't care, simply doesn't care, or is not capable of doing anything. And so we have seen this kind of proliferation of scattered protests here and there.
Thanks, Mikran. And I think one last question from the floor, from Aisha, my colleague, who is a research fellow here as well. While we are still talking about the frustration in the public, her question is, to what extent is the hijab issue considered a primary issue or a key issue of the political exit by Iranians?
That's a good question. And I think that question really depends on who you ask and kind of what cluster of people you ask. I never forget the very first time I went to Iran after many years of not having gone back. This was 20 years ago or something, or much more than 20 years ago, kind of I was hit by this, the fact that everybody in the streets had hijab. And I remember talking to a university professor, female university professor, and I said, what do we do about hijab, something? And she said something that really I had never thought about. She said, you know, it's, of course, hijab is, compulsory hijab is important, but it's become integrated into our fashion. It's become part of our daily kind of dressing up, and we have other concerns that you know, equal pay for equal work, access to sources of employment. There are those other concerns. Hijab kind of hits you in the face because it's everywhere, but there are other issues about which Iranian women care deeply, and I think this we shouldn't reduce women's concerns and women's position and womanhood to the notion of hijab, while being mindful that hijab, of course, is a key component of identity, and compulsory hijab is a key ideological pillar of the state and a huge infringement, but the whole notion goes beyond it. Now, I think there's also a distinction to be made between Tehran and elsewhere and the provinces. Because in Tehran, it's quite common to see women, if their headscarf falls, it takes them a while to put it back on in public domain, whether they're in the metro or on the street or summer. And the state has been clever enough or incapable of fully enforcing inside Tehran, fully enforcing the hijab mandate, compulsory hijab mandate. And so it kind of, that's one of those safety valves that the state either deliberately or by default has allowed it to kind of take its course. The provinces, provincial towns are slightly different. Only in some places in the public do you see women walking around without the hijab. You know, and I think, you know, in some ways the state is trying to figure out what to do about this. You know, it's been such a mainstay of the ideological pillar of the state, and so many of the men inside the state have vested their rhetoric on it, have kind of talked about the inability to compromise, and it's an affront to Islam and Islamic principles, that they kind of have pushed themselves into a corner. And, you know, I always say something, you know, one cannot help but to admire and be deeply proud of Iranian women, because for four decades, men have been trying to resist the Islamic Republic, protest against it. They have philosophized and theorized against the Islamic Republic, trying to reform it, overthrow it. They haven't gotten anywhere. And for the last three to 5 years, what we're seeing is women are openly flaunting the dictums of the Islamic Republic. And in many ways, the state is powerless to do anything about it. Former Czech playwright and later the president of Czech Republic, Václav Havel, had a saying. He used to talk about the power of the powerless. And what we're seeing is that that segment of Iranian society that the state has been trying to make most powerless, Iranian women, through compulsory hijab, through lack of access to employment and other resources, through various kinds of social, cultural, economic pressures and marginalization, that powerful sectors of Iranian society.
Thank you, Mehran. I think that's a very comprehensive answer. We can now turn a bit away from the public, because we do have some questions coming in on the politics, especially on the Wilayat of Faqih. We do have two questions. Let's just put them together. One is from my former colleague who was a visiting research professor, Georgi Bustin. His question is, how much is Grand Ayatollah Sistani of Najaf detracting from the legitimacy of Khamenei as Wilayat of Faqih? That's question number one. And we've got another question from Kenny Tan from the floor, who asks, if you could share about the current slate of prospective candidates to succeed the Supreme Leader, and whether Raisi is still the leading contender despite his missteps as president. So we have this group of questions concerning the Wilayat of Faqih and the succession question. So over to you, Mira.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, originally, the Velayat-e-Faqih, the political position of the Velayat-e-Faqih was merged with a religious position as well, which is the highest rank of Shiism, which is source of emulation, marja-e-taqlid, source of emulation. And Khamenei wasn't even an ayatollah when he became the president. When he suddenly went from Hojjatullah Islam to ayatollah and then Velayat-e-Faqih, but he never reached the rank of Hojjatullah Islam. And on two separate occasions, the Iranian clerical establishment tried to elevate him, or some people within the clerical establishment tried to elevate him to this position of source of emulation, marja-e taqlid. And the opposition against that was palpable, quite public. First time the opposition came from within the Iranian parliament, Second time, it was somewhat less blunt and less open, but came from within the clerical establishment. And then they came up with this weird arrangement whereby they said, okay, Khamenei will not be a source of emulation for the Shia inside Iran, but he will be a source of emulation for Shia outside Iran. Although figures and data are not available, anecdotal evidence is that very few Shia outside of Iran view Khamenei as their source of emulation, and most view Ayatollah Sistani, or really those who are in Najaf or the so-called quietists, political quietists. So the question really isn't the challenge by Sistani to Khamenei's legitimacy as Velayat-e-Faqih, but the question is challenge to Khamenei as the source of emulation, as the marja-e-taqlid. And in that sense, Khamenei is no competition because he's really become a political figure. And he has, in many ways, particularly for those outside of the Iranian establishment, they see him less and less. And of course, small minorities outside of Iran, they see him less and less as religious figure and more as a political figure. Now, in terms of the host candidates, no one knows. I don't think anybody really is in a position to guess. So, Kenny, I'm afraid I won't be able to give you a definite answer. But let me share with you some intelligent thoughts or some educated guesses based on what we know. One of the names that has been mentioned in the past or had been mentioned in the past is Khamenei's son, Mojtaba. And very recently, he came out with a very clear statement saying, this is not an option. Because if the Velayat-e-Faqih position goes from Khamenei to his son, we have a redo of the monarchy. And so the only thing that would be different is the title of the Velayat-e-Faqih. It won't be king or shah anymore. But, that sort of hereditary rule, Khamenei completely ruled it out. And so for the time being, at least, that's not an option. Raisi, and you mentioned a series of missteps. Absolutely. Raisi has kind of engaged in a bunch of missteps. It's been an interesting presidency because he's not popular inside the country. No offense to Mr. Raisi, but he cannot put two sentences together in Farsi without some sort of a gaffe. His Farsi is even worse than mine, and my Farsi is atrocious. But he has had some measurable successes in foreign policy. That cannot be denied. The twin pillars of the Raisi administration's foreign policy, namely the good neighborly relations and the look east policy, have had significant results, and that cannot be denied. So it depends on kind of what matrix we're going to measure Raisi presidency in terms of domestic politics and domestic popularity and his persona as a kind of a elevated figure. Iran is a society which prizes poetry, prizes command of literature. And for someone who is famous at butchering the Farsi language, Raisi has very little legitimacy domestically. But in terms of foreign policy, he's had some successes. The World Bank has come out with some rosy predictions in terms of Iran's economy. Those rosy predictions have yet to translate into people's pockets. And so in terms of inflation, employment, and purchasing power, I don't think we can say, well, Iranian economy is doing well. But if those predictions pan out, maybe by the time Khamenei departs the scene. If, you know, there's a whole constellation of factors, he certainly can re-emerge as a contender. What I discovered and what I mentioned is that constitutionally and according to the bylaws of the Assembly of Experts, there is supposed to be a commission within the Assembly of Experts whose job it is to proactively consider candidates for the Velayat-e Faqih. And at any given point, they're supposed to, in case there's a sudden vacancy, they're supposed to kind of have a whole group of candidates ready to present for a vote at the Assembly of Experts. And so we might still be surprised in the same way that we were surprised in 1989. When Khomeini died, nobody anticipated Khamenei to be the next supreme leader. And we could still be very much surprised and come out with a candidate that really has not been in the news or whose name is not part of the public discourse.
Thank you, Mehran, for sharing your take on the question of succession. I think we want to quickly touch on one more issue on internal politics before we progress and transit into the foreign policy of Iran. And I'm going to share this slide, which is from your book, The Table. And there's been analysis out there saying that the reformists, the two camps between the reformists and the conservatives, and in your book, you call it the principalists. So, you know, what is the biggest issue that is the biggest source of disagreement between the two camps? And why are reformists increasingly sidelined over time? I think these are the questions.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, this offers a snapshot, and you know, what is the biggest issue can change over time from one time to another. Right now, the biggest issue perhaps is culture, issues of the state's relationship with Iranian culture. What does the state do? To what extent does the state try to direct, manipulate, shape, and influence various dimensions of Iranian culture, particularly in terms of identity, women? You know, right now we're in the month of Ramadan. To what extent does the state look the other way when there is public or state agents look the other way if somebody is smoking in public or eating in public? The whole notion of compulsory hijab. And the other burning issue right now that really divides people is this whole notion of what do we do about the United States? Do we come to some sort of modus vivendi? Do we look for win-win scenarios? The Americans aren't going to go away. We're not going away. And so do we look for some sort of a win-win scenario, or do we continue with this adversarial relationship that has come to so pervasively characterize our interactions? And I think, you know, the whole notion of the U.S. and culture are now some of the most important dimensions that divide the reformists and the principalists. And the reformists, in many ways, and I talk about this, they share the blame as much for their own demise as the conservatives do. The reformists never articulated a coherent ideology. Some areas, for whatever reason, they never articulated a coherent position on. For example, on compulsory hijab, they never quite came out and said, this is our position or that. And they never did. Really, never articulated a coherent program. So if just this last election, for example, if there had been if the reformists had been a cohesive political force, they would have had a position months in advance, or at least weeks in advance. We are or we're not going to boycott the election. And ironically, some of the main figures, the night before the election, were meeting deep into the night to decide whether or not the next day they should go and vote or what the position ought to be. So in some ways, the reformists, yes, they have been excluded from the various levers of the state, but they also share much of the blame because they never articulated coherent positions on some key issues, election. For example, there's this whole debate in Iran as to the source of legitimacy of the Islamic Republic and the source of legitimacy, particularly of the Velayat-e Faqih. Is it divine or is it popular? Does the Velayat-e Faqih rule by divine mandate or does he rule through elections, through popular mandate? And the position, the reformists at an individual level, theoretically and philosophically, have articulated a position here and there. They've written tracts and books, but they have never fully come out and said, this is our position. The Velayat-e Faqih should be elected, or alternatively, the Velayat-e Faqih is divinely ordained, or this is our position on women. So their own inability to present a cohesive front has, even intellectually, never mind politically or as a political party, but even intellectual unity has been evasive among them, and that has undermined their popularity and, of course, their political fortunes.
Thank you, Mehran. I'll stop sharing this slide and we can now transit into questions of foreign policy. And the point you made about the US and how best to deal with the US for the Islamic Republic becoming a question of debate from Tehran, within Tehran, I think that is our apt transition point, because there is a question coming in on how successful was the Islamic Republic in facing the maximum pressure campaign by President Donald Trump, the last president. And another question, well, is about the current Gaza war. And you have, would you say that the chasm between the West and Iran is at its largest, because US and Qatari governments have frozen $6 billion in assets that were originally meant for humanitarian purposes? So these two questions on foreign policy, and obviously covers the external pressures side that you mentioned in your original initial comments at the start of this session. Yeah.
Thank you. You know, it's a given that when there are sanctions, those in positions of power do not suffer. And those who suffer are the middle classes whose purchasing power declines, those in the lower middle classes who live hand to mouth, and the lower classes who live hand to mouth, for whom there are fewer opportunities, or to put it crudely, fewer crumbs left to pick up. And so the question of did Iran emerge triumphant out of the maximum pressure depends on who you talk to. Because the middle classes had their economic positions erode further, their purchasing powers decline more, and the power elite didn't suffer. The Revolutionary Guards didn't suffer. In fact, they had fewer competition when they were bidding for various contracts, and so. You know, the maximum pressure inadvertently strengthened the hardliners and those who are kind of the arch supporters of the state, but it disempowered society even more. And this is kind of the short-sightedness of the United States, this addiction to sanctions that, because it's very inexpensive or low cost to impose, and it kind of is newsworthy, but it doesn't work. Sanctions have not worked. They haven't worked in Cuba. They're not working in Iran. They haven't worked in Russia. They just sanctions don't work. And, you know, no matter how you dress them up, call it smart sanctions, targeted sanctions, whatever, they actually have had quite the opposite effect. And the question about Gaza, yes, the chasm between Iran and the United States is wider than ever before. But I think we need to be mindful of something. And this is, I sometimes have a hard time explaining this to my friends and colleagues inside Iran. Right now, for the last however long, the United States is determined has determined that Iran is a mortal enemy. I don't know what the source of this, I mean, the rhetoric coming out of Tehran, of course, and it's human nature to look for enemies. But for the Americans, for the American electorate, for the American right and the American left, Iran is an absolute threat. It is this scary, frightening, irrational, illogical other. And so the debate between Iran and the United States, and of course the Iranian state being its own worst enemy, does anything and everything possible to perpetuate this adversarial relationship and this animosity. I'm not saying the Iranians are guiltless. They share the bulk of the guilt, but at least where the Americans are concerned, they also see Iran as this incurable enemy, regardless of what. So it's not a question of Iran's support for Hamas. It's not a question of Iran's nuclear program. It's not a question of Iran's missile program. It's a question of Iran that kind of has become the big American fixation and the big American preoccupation. If tomorrow the Iranians stop all of their military industries, we will build no more missiles, and we will build no more drones, or we will stop our nuclear program. I am willing to bet anything that the Americans are going to turn around and say, aha, but you manufacture shoelaces, and those shoelaces are a mortal threat to humanity and weapons of mass destruction. So it's not, from the American perspective, it's not a question of what Iran does, but it goes deeper and beyond that. And I always use this shoelace analogy, that if Iran were to produce only shoelaces, the Americans would find some excuse to say, well, shoelaces are a mortal threat to American interests and American allies and the United States. Now, this is not, again, I want to emphasize, this is not to absolve Iran from any of its guilt, and they do anything and everything to perpetuate this American assumption. But I think we also need to kind of be mindful that it takes two to tango, and that assumptions about Iran, the chasm between Iran and the United States, is not only Iran's doing. It also is the work of both American political elite and elite political culture, what comes out of the White House and the House of Representatives and the Senate, but also what comes out of American popular media, CNN and Fox News and everything else, and of course, popular culture, what Hollywood produces. And nowadays, the only people you can have as villains are people who have an accent like mine, people who speak with an Iranian or a Middle Eastern accent.
Thank you, Mehran. I think we've come to the end of our time today. It's been an hour, and an hour flew by. You've been really patient. You've been a gem in taking all the questions from the floor, including mine. And I don't think we have gone through the plethora of questions that I had for you, actually, because the book obviously offers much more than that into the institutional design of Iran. And we've only touched the surface. We've only scratched the surface. There's other factors like the IRGC, and the deep state that you also mentioned, rightly so, in your book, that are all very tasty stuff found in the book content. So if that obviously prompts our audience to obviously go grab a copy of their own, and I would like to remind them that discount code is KAMRAVA23, again, and you can get it off the Cambridge University Press website. So thank you, Mehran, for joining us today again. And thank you to our audience for your questions. We hope to see you again on one of our events. We have the Gulf GCC Film Festival coming up at in the second half of March. So do look out for that on our website. And thank you. Thank you all. And thank you, Mehran, again.